everyone. You're listening to The Katie Halper Show, and I'm your host, Katie Halper. If you like the show, please leave us a five-star review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. And as always, we remind you that this show could not happen without the support of our listeners. To support the show, visit patreon.com/The Katie Halper Show, where for just $1 a month, you can make this show happen. And for $5 a month, you get great bonus content, including extended interviews, bonus episodes, sneak peeks at my upcoming documentary feature film, and more. Hello, and welcome to The Katie Halper Show. We have a stellar show for you today. I'll be speaking to Abdul Sayed about running for the Senate in Michigan. Then I'll play an interview I did with the Irish hip-hop trio Kneecap in Cuba. And then a fascinating discussion with Palestinian journalist Wally Rashid and JFK expert Ken McCarthy about Israel, nuclear weapons, and JFK. But before we start the show, I, of course, want to remind people to like the stream, because that helps us fight back against our tech overlords and corporate masters and algorithmic suppression. So give it a thumbs up. We want to make sure that as many people as possible see these streams, and giving it a like helps that happen. If you haven't already subscribed, please do subscribe to the channel by hitting subscribe and then the bell. That way you won't miss any of our streams or clips. And you definitely want to do this because we've been doing a lot of extra streams so that we can talk to people based in different parts of the world, like Iran, who can't really do a 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time stream. So as people know, we do stream at 7 p.m. EST every Tuesday night, but we've been doing these extra streams outside of that time window. So those are daytime streams on other days of the week. For instance, we're definitely going to be speaking to Dr. Mohammed Mirandi, who will be joining us from Tehran. We are not sure yet what day this week or weekend we'll be doing that, but that's why you should subscribe so that you can find out about that. And please make sure that you help this show happen by becoming Patreon supporters. To do that, you go to patreon.com/The Katie Halper Show. Again, that's patreon.com/The Katie Halper Show. We really literally could not do this show without your support on Patreon. For just $5 a month, you get to make this show happen and you get tons of bonus and extra content. This week, for example, you get the full interview with Ken and Wally about JFK and Israel. If you can't do the $5 a month level, you can still make the show happen by paying $1 a month, which is $12 a year. Okay, so now, without any further ado, here is my interview with Abdul El-Sayed. Welcome back to the show. I interviewed you a few years ago, I think in Vermont at the People's Summit. Dr. Abdul El-Sayed, tell us what you're running for and why you're running for it.
Yeah, hey, Katie, it's great to be back in touch. And I'm running for U.S. Senate here in the great state of Michigan. And I'm running because it just shouldn't be this hard. Shouldn't be this hard to afford a second bag of groceries, put a roof over your head. Shouldn't be this hard to send your kid to a dignified school, to know that the job that you worked yesterday and yesterday before is going to be there for you tomorrow. Shouldn't be this hard to take your kid to a doctor. Now, I was never supposed to run for office. I'm a doctor, as you know. I rebuilt Detroit's health department, led Wayne County's. We did things like put glasses on kids, take on corporate polluters, put Narcan in vending machines, and eliminate medical debt. And I'm running to get money out of politics, put money in your pocket, and pass Medicare for all.
Great. And how did working in public health and studying medicine shape your view of the world and also of what you would do as senator?
Public health offers you a lens to ask, is this contributing to people's ability to live a long, healthy, dignified, and joyful life? And it changes the way you think about how we ought to spend scarce resources. Right now, government wants to tell us the best use of our tax dollars is to burn $2 billion a day to kill other people's kids and bomb their hospitals and their schools and spike our gas prices rather than to invest in our own kids and our own schools and our own healthcare. I trained as a physician, and that gives you the ability and the training to sit with people in moments of their worst pain. And I actually think that that is one of the most important preparations for life in politics, in the sense that at its best, our politics is about forging purpose out of pain. And so you need to be able to be in a mind space and to be someone who's trustworthy enough that people want to bring to you the challenges of their life, believing that collectively we can solve it. And so my goal is to be able to forge purpose out of pain, purpose to build the kind of America where we invest in our kids, invest in our future, invest in our schools, invest in clean air, clean water, rather than investing in the things that too often government has been focused on right now, cutting taxes for billionaires, while those same billionaires take some of the money that they save, invest in our politics to make sure that the system keeps going, rather than investing in us.
So tell me about how the Flint, Michigan water crisis, to me, that really exemplifies bipartisan rot, right? Because you had a Republican governor, but you also had a lot of complicity from the Democrats, including the Attorney General, Dana Nessel, who basically decided not to hold anyone accountable. Tell us more about this.
So Flint was a terrible disaster, and the water crisis happened because of choices that were made on the part of the Republican governor at the time. They instituted this thing called emergency management, which, by the way, was also the reason that they shut down Detroit's health department, which I was hired to rebuild after that. And under emergency management, the emergency manager, which was basically a czar who oversaw everything, their job was not to make sure that operations were effective. Their job was to make sure that they were cutting corners to cut costs. And that's when they made that disastrous choice to change the Flint water source from the Great Lakes to the Flint River, cut corrosion controls, ultimately ended up corroding iron, leaded pipes that leached lead into our babies' bones and their brains. And it was a terrible, terrible situation. But part and parcel of all of this is a politics that tells us that the central goal of government is to cut rather than to provide very basic resources like clean drinking water. And we've seen, unfortunately, a willingness to assent to that logic on the part of both parties. And that exact kind of politics, that kind of neoliberal thinking that tells us that markets can solve it, that business knows better than government, has left us in a position where big business, big corporations, billionaires are able to use their power to corrupt our government officials to do their bidding. Whenever they privatize out, those privatizing efforts always end up in the back pocket of some contractor who ends up making yet more money. And that's exactly the kind of governance that I'm trying to push us beyond. I believe in a government that works for people, that guarantees people healthcare, that invests in great schools. And I believe in an economy that is built for and by small businesses rather than big corporations that centers around the dignity of the worker through union rights. And I believe at the heart of all of that is getting corporate money out of politics.
Okay. And tell me about your opponents. What is your response to the claim that there are other people in the race who are progressive Democrats?
I'll just say that I'm the only one in my race who's never touched a dime of corporate money. We all ran together in 2018. The likes of our local utility, DTE, the likes of Blue Cross Blue Shield, they were spending money to help elect the opponents I'm running against now in 2018, and they're spending money to beat me. So it tells you who's been true to this, not just new to this. I'm the only one running on Medicare for All. I'm the only one who believes that you cannot reform or replace ICE or retrain ICE. You need to abolish it and replace. I'm the only one running in this race who has been consistent on these positions since I started in politics in 2018 when I ran for governor. But not only that, it's the kind of campaign we're running. I don't ask corporations to pay for my campaigns. I'm not asking the Israel lobby to pay for my campaigns. I am asking everyday people to support me in this run. And you know, when it comes to foreign policy, I'm not the kind of person who believes that my politics and my principles end at the border. That if we believe in peace, dignity, and self-determination, that has to apply to all people. I was not afraid to call a genocide way back because, of course, I don't want my tax dollars being spent on genocide. I want my tax dollars being spent here at home to provide healthcare and good schools to people here at home. I stand up against genocide because I love people. The same way that I love the Jewish people and Judaism, I love the Palestinian people, and I believe in everybody's equal rights to peace, dignity, and self-determination. Now, for a lot of reasons, politicians don't say those things, in large part because they're afraid of backlash from the likes of AIPAC, backlash from the likes of big corporations. I'm just not afraid of that. I would rather be in a situation where I don't hold office than be in a situation where I hold office and find myself unable to do the things for which I wanted to hold office.
All right. Can you talk about your family background and how perhaps this has shaped your view? Although I want to be very clear that you're someone who I'm sure if you had been born to, I don't know, Vietnamese and Croatian parents or something, you'd be as anti-genocide as you are. But tell us about your family's story.
Well, I was the eldest son born to Egyptian immigrants. My parents had me and quickly got divorced and both remarried. I was raised by my dad and my stepmom, Jackie, who's a daughter of the American Revolution. And one of the things my upbringing taught me is that, you know, whether it's your grandmother who never got to go to school, raised six kids of eight to whom she gave birth, two having died before their first birthday, who raised those kids in a one-bedroom apartment in Alexandria. Or it's your grandma who raised her three kids in a bungalow in the Midwest, who trained as a nurse in Flint. When your grandmother kisses you on the forehead and tells you she loves you and makes your favorite meal, it's done with the same love. So in a lot of ways, it's
probably
not about
better the Egyptian meal though.
Not gonna lie. But I will tell you this, that it's when you are not fully a member of any one tribe and your existence in the world or any one group is always complicated by your other existences, you tend to revert to the least common denominator of your experience, which is the human experience. And so, you know, I try to lead with principles and apply those principles evenly, regardless for whom they apply. So my position when it comes to genocide is that I love people. I love Jewish people. I love Palestinian people. And I would never sit idly by as people get destroyed. And I also don't believe that any one people's pain is more important or carries more dignity than anyone else's. So I think it behooves all of us to ask, what are our principles as people, and then apply those principles equally and honestly. You know, it's the reason that I've stood against the government of the UAE for the genocide that they perpetrate in Sudan. It's the reason that I stand against the government of Israel for the genocide that they perpetrated in Gaza. It's the reason that I stand for healthcare for everybody in our country. It is because I believe in people, the dignity of people, and the responsibility to serve people.
I think you said least common denominator and you meant most common denominator. Do you want to, right? Am I right that you want to say that?
Well, technically, mathematically, it would be the least common denominator, but also it is the least common denominator for which most people experience. So,
okay, there you go. See, whatever brain is not math, that's my brain. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's like, okay. It's like technically the denominator is on the bottom of the fraction. So when it's small,
Oh, I get it. Oh my God. Thank God my math teachers don't watch the show. I hope my former math teachers. Okay. So, you know, sometimes people get pigeonholed, like Rashida Tlaib, who obviously is from your great state. She gets pigeonholed as like the Palestine person, the Palestinian congresswoman, but she's great on so many issues. I mean, environmental justice, racial justice, and these things, of course, are related. So can you talk about how all of these things are related? Immigration, genocide, environmental justice, anti-Black racism, the devastation of the working class, NAFTA, stuff like that.
Well, Katie, I think you're highlighting a really important thing, which is you see a lot of politicians here who are willing to give up on the conversation about Palestinian rights because there's so much money and power stacked toward denying the rights of Palestinians. And so they'll give up on that and they'll say, well, I'm good on everything else. But if you're willing to stand full-throated, right, with a clear chest, 10 toes down, to talk about equal rights for Palestinians, that means you're going to fight like hell on all the other ones over which there's just not nearly as much opposition. You know, in my race, the estimates suggest that AIPAC is going to spend $20 million to beat me. They've called me the single most dangerous candidate for the U.S.-Israel relationship because of my ability to connect domestic and foreign policy. And it's true. I'm the guy who wrote the book on Medicare for All. My whole life's work has been about putting glasses on kids and taking on corporate polluters. But because I'm willing to extend the same dignities to the Palestinians, all of a sudden now $20 million of AIPAC spending is coming for my face. But if you know that I'm willing to speak the truth wherever it be, even against $20 million of corrupting spending on the part of a MAGA-funded super PAC, then you know I'm going to show up when it comes to making sure that your kid gets healthcare, that you get the dignity of a union, and that corporations aren't dominating your political and economic system. And so it follows, right? When you're willing to hold down on your values, regardless who the opposition is, that you're going to be a fighter on those values. And you see that in somebody like Rashida Tlaib, and you're going to see that in me as a U.S. senator.
So speaking of AIPAC and people who are very supportive of Israel, there was an interesting interaction between you and Olivia Rheingold of the Free Press. Abdul El-Sayed, who is Muslim, walks a fine line on the Jewish state. On Tuesday night, he told the crowd, as he often does, that his problem is not with Jews. All of us love and revere Jewish folk, our Jewish neighbors, the faith of Judaism, he said, hands outstretched. He rebuffed my question on whether he believes in Israel's right to exist as a Jewish state. What do you mean by Jewish state? He retorted, narrowing his eyes. If you can't answer that question, I'm not going to answer it. And here's the actual video of what happened.
We're going to take two more questions. I'm sorry. We're going to have to move on to the next person. I'm sorry, Olivia.
As a Jewish state.
Olivia, we're going to have to move on.
So I'd love to take the question. I'd love to take a question, actually.
Thank you.
What do you mean by Jewish state?
I feel like
if you can't define their question, I'm not going to answer your question.
So it's fascinating to me that what does a Jewish state mean? It can be a gotcha question. Do you think that most people would actually have a different opinion of what should be done if they understood what the current Jewish state of Israel means?
I think most people have in their heart of hearts a commitment to foundational equity, that everybody deserves equal rights to peace, dignity, and self-determination. The reason I ask that question is because it's very difficult to square that question with equal rights for Palestinian people, right? Whether you're defining a Jewish state based on an actual state religion, right? Which means that some people don't belong as much because they may not belong to the same faith. And even within the faith, which interpretation of Judaism are you talking about? Because there are folks who would not consider, folks who consider themselves Jewish as Jewish enough. And then if you're doing it by identity, then the question becomes, well, is it the identity of the leadership or is it the majority of the country? All of these become really, really difficult to square with any semblance of equal rights. And so I just wanted to understand what she was actually asking me. And I think it's really important for all of us to be asking those questions, because at the end of the day, all of this gets hashed out in public policy. So if your interpretation of the identity of a state would then in some respects allow that state to do things like discriminate against people for how they pray or discriminate against people because of their ethnicity, I don't think most of us would be okay with that. And I'll say that about any country. I don't believe in ethnostates. I just don't. I believe in the equal human dignity of all people. And I'm grateful that I live in the United States of America, where there is no state religion and there is no state language and there is no state identity. And I worry about the same forces who are trying to create one here that we've seen around the world. And, you know, to be clear, I don't care if that's a state that shares the same ethnic or faith identity I do or not. I just don't believe in the idea that people should be allowed to discriminate against one another or that we should have whole power structures based on, you know, who people are.
You've been attacked by the likes of Fox News, but also by CNN, Dana Bash in particular.
Which is funny because I worked for CNN for 3 years, but yeah.
Whoa, what did you do for them?
I was a commentator at CNN. I used to share insight about COVID and about politics. And, you know, the very same people attacking me are people who have my phone number. So they could call me if they want to. But of course, that's not the... goal here.
Exactly.
You know, it's folks wanting to take bad faith arguments out of context, to, you know, smear your character. And unfortunately that's the nature of our politics. And I think it's what so many people pay attention to creators like you, instead of tuning into the likes of Fox or CNN, because they get a sense that they're, getting a fuller picture.
Right. And Dana Bash and Jake Tapper, waiting for you to comment, even tweet about the documented rapes of Palestinians, because you claim to care about rape and sexual assault, which is important to care about, but maybe you would care about it. If you could care about it, even when it happens to Palestinians, that would be an amazing thing. Okay, that's me talking. That's not, I don't want that to blow back on you.
I oppose rape and sexual assault. I oppose terrorism. I oppose all of these things, which is why I think it's just so important for us to be asking, how do we make sure we're applying our morals and our principles the same way everywhere.
Right. And you, I actually thought your comment about the recent attack was very nuanced and very accurate.
Yesterday, our state was rocked by news of a heinous attack on Temple Israel, a synagogue in West Bloomfield, Michigan. An armed assailant drove his truck into the building where there are 140 children. Because of the heroism of Temple security and law enforcement, the assailant was disarmed and ultimately killed. No teachers, children, or congregants were physically harmed. I'm so relieved. I grew up not 15 minutes away from Temple Israel. Many of my childhood friends and classmates worshiped there. I shudder to think through the emotions of the parents whose children were in the synagogue. This attack will leave scars on the inside that'll stay with the community for decades. These scars, they'll echo centuries of trauma on the part of the Jewish people, calling back the memories of atrocities, including the Holocaust, against Jewish people that are torn afresh every time something like this happens. To my Jewish sisters and brothers, I want to reaffirm my commitment to your rights to worship, to learn, to practice, and to celebrate your faith. Anti-Semitism has no place in our communities, ever. Full stop. Yesterday, we also learned that the attacker was Ayman Ghazali. He was Arab American and Muslim. I condemn what he did. There is never a justification for attacking innocent people or houses of worship. Never. As an epidemiologist, I've spent my career studying the worst things that happen to people to understand how to stop them from happening. And I'll never forget one of the simplest lessons I learned while on my psychiatry rotation in medical school. Hurt people hurt people. Violence is a cycle. Ayman Ghazali lost family, including two children, in an airstrike in Lebanon last week. They were innocent people. And then, in an evil act of displaced rage, he tried to take it out on innocent children who had nothing to do with the loss of the innocent children he lost, except that they share a faith. Temple Israel is not the state of Israel. Jewish people are not the state of Israel. And the people of Israel are not the political actors who make direct choices for the state of Israel. We cannot and must not conflate these, an act rooted in anti-Semitism. One can have righteous anger at the actions of the state of Israel while expressing solidarity with the Jewish people, including Jewish people in Israel. The conflation of these, whether in the dastardly way Ayman Ghazali did or in an effort to use the specter of anti-Semitism to defend the indefensible, it sits at the root of our failure to stop this violence. Ayman Ghazali hurt people. There is no justification for what he did. It was wrong and he never should have done it. Hurt people hurt people. A week earlier, an airstrike killed his niece and nephew. Imagine if that had never happened. Imagine there was no war in Iran. Imagine if there were no airstrikes in Lebanon. Imagine if his family had never died. Imagine there was never an attack on Temple Israel. That's the world that we want to live in. That's the world we need to build for. Violence always begets violence. Only peace can extinguish that.
I wanted folks to understand that offering context is not the same as justifying.
Yes.
Or equivocating.
Right.
But if we're serious about preventing something from happening, you actually really want to understand the context. You really do. I worry that our public conversation has gotten so profoundly unserious that we are unwilling to have a nuanced discussion about why violence happens. Instead, there's always a pointing at, as if this is just one big clash between good and evil. That's not how the world works. And I condemned the attack on Temple Israel as anti-Semitic, violent, and wrong, full stop. I also wanted us to understand what might have created the context within which that happened.
Exactly.
And, you know, for doing that, people decided that they wanted to come after me. At the end of the day, my job is not to defend myself, honestly. My job is to defend folks who have been defenseless against a system of politics that has created far too much violence in the world. And I'm just very serious about trying to prevent that violence from happening. Now, you know, folks are going to use bad faith attacks. It is what it is. I'm a big boy. I know what I got into. But I want folks to understand that we really can have an adult conversation about the wrong things that happened and why they happened and what we can do to prevent them from happening in the future. And I'm going to keep doing that.
Yeah. I mean, just very quickly, I will say as a Jew, I don't think that what Israel does, I mean, it's immoral, it's illegal, it's unethical, it's a stain on humanity. It also happens to not make Jews safer. And I think it kind of related to what your point is. I mean, it's pretty bad for the Jews to have Israel committing live streaming a genocide. And even in many cases, you see the IDF celebrating it and claiming that that's in the name of all Jews. So if you care about Jewish safety, my fellow Jews, maybe speak out against Israel. That's my advice. You made a very interesting point on Ali Velshi's show the other day. You said public trust is hard to earn and easy to lose. It's not enough to push back on RFK Jr. if we're not fixing the reason people lost trust in the system in the first place, that it's motivated by greed, that's why I fight for Medicare for All. Can you talk about that more, like the politics of condemnation or Trump bashing? Not that you are like Trump, but for a lot of Democrats, it seems like their entire messaging and even policy is just saying we're not as bad as Trump. And even when it comes to Iran, and what is your opinion on what should be done to Iran, in Iran, vis-a-vis Iran?
I said the first time I ran that Donald Trump himself is not the disease. He's just the worst symptom of a very terrible disease. And it's a disease that allows corporations and oligarchs and billionaires and special interests to buy and sell politicians that leave the system getting rigged against us. It's the reason we pay more for the stuff we buy. It's the reason we get paid less for the work we do. It's the reason that our tax dollars get misappropriated to kill other people instead of empower our own. And if you're not serious about taking on the disease, you're actually not serious about taking on the symptom. The war in Iran is a perfect example. You've got Democrats out here saying, well, it's illegal, but then trying to justify it. To me, it's unjustifiable and illegal, which is why I would never vote to fund it. But you've got people saying, ah, well, you know, if they ask for the money for it, I think I'd have to. And you're like, well, aren't you then just giving it your blessing anyway? And it's this attempt to walk a fine line that looks so ridiculous. And again, it's just profoundly unserious. So yes, we should bash the shit out of Trump because he's a terrible human being who does awful things, who's exploited a lot of pain in a lot of people. And also, we've got to be serious about addressing that pain if we're serious about beating him and, more importantly, winning the future. Because let me just be clear about this. Beating Trump is not enough. You've got to actually address the circumstances that create all of this pain. You've got to build great schools. You've got to provide great healthcare. You've got to empower people to have the means of being able to put food on their table and put a roof over their head. If you're not doing those things, then you're not really solving the problem. You're just solving part of the problem. You're treating the symptom and not the disease.
And last question, what do you say to people who say, oh, Democrats are losing because they're not tough enough on the border?
I think you're falling prey to a talking point that is just not consistent with what everyday people feel. I've been all over my state. We are a border state, just the other border. You know what they're not asking me about? They're not asking me about the border. They're asking me about how am I going to afford my groceries? How am I going to afford my healthcare? How am I going to afford to keep this roof over my head? That's what they're asking about. Now, the reason folks do talk about the border is because Donald Trump told them that it was because of the border. His summation of all of this is that if you're out of a job, it's because an immigrant took your job. If you're out of healthcare, it's because an immigrant took your healthcare. If you're out of a home, it's because an immigrant took your home. We got a better argument. If you're out of a job, it's because a corporation offshored or automated your job. If you're out of a home, it's because a corporation is speculating on the home you should have been able to afford. If you're out of healthcare, it's because a corporation is figuring out how to monetize you simply for getting sick. But if you're taking money from the same corporations who are causing the problem, you're probably not going to talk about the corporation, which is why too many Democrats don't talk about it. Right. So it is not about the southern border, right? Even if Donald Trump has been able to weaponize the southern border around the issues that people actually feel. We've got a better argument. The way you beat a bad argument is with a better argument. We've got that argument. We just can't be a part of making corporate politics part of a two-party agreement. And so we're running a campaign, again, to get money out of politics, because that's where all these other problems start, and then put money in pockets and pass Medicare for all.
Great. And anything else you want to say, or websites you want to mention where people can learn more about you?
This is a people-powered movement. I don't take money from corporations. I'm the only person who never has and never will running for U.S. Senate in Michigan. I hope folks will get involved. Go to abdulforsenate.com. Follow us on socials. Keep listening to great content creators. And we hope to see you out there. It's going to be an amazing next 4 months as we start building this movement to win our politics back. So I hope folks will get involved.
And you've been endorsed by Bernie Sanders.
Bernie Sanders, Ro Khanna, Rashida Tlaib, Pramila Jayapal, Andy Levin,
nice.
More local officials in Michigan than any other candidate. But we're building a groundswell of a movement here.
Okay, great. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
That was such a pleasure talking to Abdul. And we have even more show for you. And as a reminder, don't forget to like the stream and subscribe and become Patreon subscribers if you haven't already. Now, here's an interview I did with Kneecap, the Irish hip hop trio from Belfast. They're very outspoken about Palestine and now about Cuba. And as viewers know, last month, I, along with hundreds of other people, took part in a Cuba convoy organized by Code Pink and Progressive International, which brought tons of humanitarian supplies and medicine to the island. And Kneecap also took part. So this interview you're about to see comes from a very small press conference they did right after performing at a great festival at Pabellon in Havana. Now, the Miami lobby obviously hates when people bring humanitarian aid to the people of Cuba or show any solidarity with them. So they smeared this convoy with a bunch of really laughable lies. One of my favorite lies was the claim that a Kneecap performance that consisted of three songs was responsible for a nationwide blackout. That, of course, wasn't true. Kneecap was only one of the many bands and musicians who performed at the concert, but also that's not how blackouts work. But people are so desperate to smear because they know that saying out loud, please starve the people of Cuba, isn't a good look. So they have to resort to these desperate measures. So without any further ado, here is my interview with Niqab.
How was the concert?
Yeah, very enjoyable. I mean, unfortunately, we only did the three songs. I think the Cubans are very like the Irish. Like, we don't need an excuse to party. Like, we'll party at the drop of a hat, you know? And it's beautiful actually to come here friendly and to see, you know, the similarities between Cuba and Ireland. We have such shared history, and just to see everyone out there, you know, the resilience.
You can't make it up. You can't make that up.
Viva, viva, Palestina! Viva, viva, Palestina!
Free Palestine! Free Cuba! Fuck Trump! Fuck Netanyahu!
Something that I find fascinating is that, and I'm not just saying this to flatter people in the room, but I really do think that of all the people I've met and places I've been, the nicest people and kindest people and most generous people are the Irish, the Cuban, and the Palestinians. And I'm wondering if you think that any of this shared struggle has affected almost the character of your people in a positive way. I mean, I'm not romanticizing it.
You know, I think there's a reason that you said the Cubans, the Irish, and Palestinians are some of the nicest people you meet, because I think what happens is during times of struggle or during a long periods of struggle, it breeds people who are, you know, willing to help. Like, you go to West Belfast, I mean, it's a community that's been fucking impoverished for a long time. And again, that's by design by the British government. There's a reason the community has been, you know, impoverished and lack of infrastructure and stuff. But what happens is these people know what it's like to go without. So whenever you grow up knowing what it's like to go without, you don't want to see your friend, your brother, your sister, your neighbor going without, you know? So I think that there's a reason for that. I think tough times breed the best people.
And a sense of community, I think that's how communities get through when there's, be it in the north during the Troubles or in Palestine or in Cuba. And a sense of community is how people get through these times. And I think oppressors, like people who commit oppression, they always think that the people they're oppressing are going to commit the same things to them. And that's what they get wrong.
Right.
And that's what they're wrong. Even though Cuba's not, I don't see Cuba invading any countries, only with doctors.
Right.
So, yeah. So, you know, they're not bombing countries and stuff like that there. So yeah. I think it's that sense of community is something that is the way to get through these things. But I think that is something that is a thing that could be a mistake about oppressed people, that they're going to commit the same things, but generally speaking, but I mean, that's
true. I think there's the language that's used by colonizing power is very kind of, it's obviously repressive. And even when the Brits were trying to colonize Ireland, they would say, "We're here to civilize these savages."
Yeah. That was true.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, we are still savages, but let us be savage independently.
Yeah, but the civilization that they brought has been far from civil. You know, yeah. And the people, a lot of these people on the, like, especially island countries, like we talk about Cuba, Ireland, like, and Palestine as well. But these people have a lot more connection to the land, and it goes back generations. And that's why in these countries you see how they're not so quick to cut down the forests, and they're not so quick to
respect.
Yeah, so they respect the land they're from, because they realize that maybe they speak in Irish, part about the mother country and the land, and it's this kind of feminine entity that bore you and give birth to you and looks after you, and you take from the land and you give back to the land when you die. And that's all kind of been lost in this kind of, like, the
capitalism
that's doing, just everything's being individualized. Everybody's just staying in their own rooms, watching their own TVs, stuff to their own phones. You know, but like, if you break it down, like, in simpler terms, but that's basically what it is. And like, that connection to land and the connection to your heritage and to just to get to your land and your heritage, basically, that's been lost. And that's what they need to kind of, that's why you see this international solidarity with all these countries trying to get that back, because like, there's a wave happening now that's trying to just wipe all that out.
Now. You just remind me of how every accusation is a confession. They say that about, you know, Israel a lot, and you do see it with the British and also with the states with Cuba and the accusation of terrorism that is always thrown by the actual terrorists against the people who are not terrorists.
So Israel believes that all its neighbors are trying to eradicate Israel when in actual fact the opposite is true.
And they thought that they once called Nelson Mandela terrorist, and now he has a statue in Parliament Square. So they called him a terrorist a couple of weeks ago.
Oh, yeah.
And he's been vindicated.
Yeah.
Mandela.
Yeah.
He was in the list of the terrorists people in 2012, I think.
Yeah.
You know, and we were up at Bobby Sands, and like Maggie Thatcher called the hunger strikers, and she came out and took away all their rights. And in Ireland in 1969, people were marching on the streets for their civil rights. Like, there was like gerrymandering happening in Ireland as well. And you know, like, it's kind of, there's a supremacy happening, and it's been happening for a while, but it's kind of coming to the fore now, and the fascism's coming to the fore again, and it needs to be stamped out quickly, because like we've seen what happened before and it's happening again here. So like, people need to challenge it where it's happening, and it's happening here in Cuba, and it's happening in Palestine.
Big Ted, right? So what happens when you get us after a gig? We're full of a job. We won't stop fucking talking.
The sanctions have to do with the ideology and the philosophy that the Hutus have, and that is the biggest threat to America. But America is, you know, a capitalist society that is all about individualism. I think the communal nature of support that the Cuban society has is the biggest threat to America.
I love that in Cuba. Everyone calls you family as well. I didn't know that was a thing. It's great. I'm taking that home. We're here to provide a short-term relief. Like we're not here. We're not going to fix anything. We're here to provide, the basic humanitarian aid that we could possibly bring with us. It's not going to solve things. It's not the end of the issue, as James said earlier. It's just the start. Mm. It's also, we're also here as, you know, as representatives from Ireland, who are, you know, for a long time, we've had massive solidarity with Cuba and vice versa. So that being said, it feels like it's our duty to be here as Irish people. Again, we're not going to solve everything, but we're here to do what we can. I think it's important as well. A lot of the questions, like we're learning. Do you know what I mean? We're not here as experts. We're here to learn.
Muchas gracias.
Viva, viva Palestina!
Viva, viva Palestina!
Viva, viva
Palestina! Viva, viva Palestina!
Love Kneecap. And now, the final interview of the show is with Wally Rashid, a Palestinian-American journalist, and Ken McCarthy, a JFK researcher. And where are you now, by the way?
I'm in Barcelona.
Oh, you're already there, right?
Yeah, so we're already here. The boats leave, I think, Tuesday. They're supposed to leave on Sunday, but there might be some weather delay. So Tuesday, and this is the biggest. I mean, there's over 100 boats.
Wow.
So we'll see how things go. Israel's kind of preoccupied, so I don't know what's going to happen. I have no idea how things are going to go. You know, they could take things. They could go in any direction. Like, I mean, they're crazy. They don't really have any boundaries. So
right.
Yeah, they droned the boats last time.
Right, I remember, yeah.
Yeah, so I don't know, and we'll see how, you know, the media attention will work, because, I don't know, we'll see, but it's good. It'll be the last, I think it's the kind of they recognize that this is kind of the last chance we really have to just do it.
Right.
So,
they have had some success in actually getting, well, it was that the Gaza fishermen were able to fish, right? Because of the distraction of the flotilla, I believe.
Yeah. Yep. Exactly.
So even that makes a difference. Yeah.
So, yeah, and I don't know. I mean, it's 100. Last time we got pretty close. I think one of our boats was like 5 kilometers out, which is super close.
Wow. Have you done this before? Have you been part of the flotilla before?
Yeah, so I actually managed. So last time I did half the mission. I'm Palestinian. They don't let Palestinians go all the way. But I managed the entire security camera system for the fleet.
Wow.
Yeah, so that's kind of why I've been running around installing cameras all day. So I've been here for about a month now and just kind of doing that sort of work.
Oh, wow. That's amazing. Yeah. Where's your family from? What's been your family's trajectory?
Yeah, my family's from a village in the West Bank called Burin. It's close to the city of Nablus. And they, there's, you know, so, I mean, all the, a lot of the settlers are radical. There's one settler, it's a settlement in the West Bank, and it's right next to my family's village. It's called the Yitzhar. And it's the ideology from Yitzhar, there's only one Zionist designated, U.S. designated terrorist group. And it's actually from my family's village. They're called Kahan Chai.
Like Kahani? Like that?
Kahan Chai. You know Kahan, the guy who...
Yeah, Kahani, like, yeah.
Yeah, so his ideology started in my the settlement next to my family's village. So, I mean, they've always just been terrorizing them. During Biden's administration, I worked with a team of lawyers implementing sanctions at the State Department. We were actually able to get a few of the settlers at my family's village sanctioned. And then day one, Trump reversed the sanctions.
Right.
Yes. So I work with a lot of, like, you know, I do a lot of political stuff, trying to push for sanctions. Like, there's a resolution right now that's kind of just like in limbo. I'm waiting to, like, hopefully push for a vote on it after midterms. I'm here in the EU. We're trying to, like, do the same thing with settlers. So a lot of my focus is really on settler violence. You know, that's kind of really what I prioritize.
Wasn't one of the people killed in the West Bank who had worked on no other land? He was killed by someone who had been sanctioned under Trump, I believe. I mean, excuse me, who had been sanctioned under Biden and then whose sanction had been lifted.
Yeah. Who's this guy's name you're referring to?
I can't remember, but he was. So the guy who was killed. Hold on.
And, you know, it's crazy because the thing is, it doesn't matter if every country in the West sanctions these settlers. The only country that matters is U.S. sanctions, because we're the global reserve currency, and all global transactions go through our banking system. So it doesn't matter, you know, Canada sanctioned all of them. They still have the sanctions. But I mean, it's unless they have Canadian dollar or whatever, you know, the Canadian currency, and they have Canadian banks, it really doesn't matter. And none of them do. So,
This person who was killed, Auda Hathalin is his name. He was killed. He was an activist and consultant on No Other Land, the documentary. He was shot and killed by Israeli settler Yinon Levy in the village of Al-Khair in the South Hebron Hills, West Bank.
Yinon Levi. Yeah. I do, or is it Levy? Okay. That's how they pronounce
it. Well, I don't know, honestly. Yeah.
Yeah. I do remember that name. So, you know, I can't remember the name of the last, it's like a two part name, but, they would have been sanctioned. The only organization that was sanctioning the State Department was the one that I was working with.
Wow.
So there was only one really doing it, was Dawn, Democracy for the Arab World Now.
Right.
And they were really sweet, because when I started working with them, I'm like, listen, I'll fundraise, I'll do whatever. I just really want you guys to target the settlement next to my family. And we did a lot of work on that. And look, I mean, there was so much evidence on it too. So it was pretty easy to get them sanctioned. And I had my family actually send a lot of the footage that they've experienced as evidence to the State Department.
Wow. Yeah, I would, I'll try, I can, that's really disturbing and not surprising at all. Unfortunately. So yeah. I'm looking at this article. Let's see. It's from October 2025 at Al Jazeera. It says, every time Yinon Levy returns to Al-Khair, where videos and witness testimonies implicate him in the murder of Auda Hathalin, anger stirs within the community. Seeking to prevent further arrests or violence, village leaders urge people to hide in their homes. He's a notorious Israeli settler sanctioned by the European Union and several governments for violent attacks on Palestinian communities in the South Hebron Hills, including spearheading the expulsion of Palestinians from Kirbet Zanuta village. And I'm just looking because I know.
Yeah, I see. Actually, I found it that you're right. It was under Biden. They did sanction him on April 19th of 2024. And then the sanctions, I guess they were actually implemented on February 1st, 2024. Yeah, and it was also the organizations that were helping him was Mount Hebron Fund. I mean, that's the thing. When they were sanctioned, there were U.S. And they're nonprofits too. They're U.S. Zionist nonprofits fundraising money. The whole point of the sanctions is you can't engage in financial transactions. And of course, you know, they really, I don't know. I feel like they just get away with so much. It really doesn't matter.
So yeah, the day Auda was shot dead, An excavator owned and operated by Levy attempted to plow through this private Palestinian land. As villagers tried to stop the excavator with some throwing rocks, Levy came out of the machine and fired twice into the crowd of villagers, among them women and children. One bullet struck Auda, who filmed his own death in the chest. Levy released to house arrest by the police the same day. 3 days later, an Israeli judge released him from house arrest, agreeing with Levy's claims that he was acting in self-defense. Just days after he shot Auda, Levy was back in the village. I mean, it's absolutely disgusting. And again, this is, you know, these are people who have somewhat of a profile because this guy, Auda, was involved in this documentary. But I actually interviewed someone from the town that is covered in this documentary, and he says, you know, there's actually a lot of vindictive behavior towards them for having participated in this documentary that won an Academy Award. It doesn't matter, though.
Oh, my gosh. It's so disgusting. And it's the thing. It's like, I don't understand the Trump administration removed sanctions on people that are murderers. Like, that is what? How? Yeah. You know what I mean? You would think that that would be at least the one thing that they would just leave their murderers.
Right. Like, just for like PR sake. Right. Like, we know they don't care about Palestinians, but you'd think that just for appearance,
you know, and you know, what's funny is that the sanctions, the way the legislation, the executive order that Biden implemented, it wasn't even just against Palestinians. It said anybody that leads to the displacement are Palestinians or commits violence in the West Bank. So if a Palestinian did it to an Israeli, they would have gotten sanctioned too. Thing was, it affected the settlers more.
Of course, yeah.
So they just didn't, they just wanted it gone.
So how are your family members who are there?
I mean, not too good, honestly. They've they're constantly terrorized, and they've had, you know, their cars set on fire. They just basically kind of have to stay in their homes. The IDF constantly raids. My uncle's neighbor, and that's what really caused me to start speaking out, was killed. He was 13. And he was killed, I think, November of 20, about just a month off after October 7th. And he was killed by settlers from Yitzhar. And then the IDF, you know, like covered it up and said it was an accident. And but the thing is, you can't tell that sometimes the difference between the IDF and the settlers, because the settlers will just put on their IDF uniform and come down.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. And so they totally work with them, right? It's not like a rogue element
they're one and the same. And if they aren't the IDF themselves, the IDF will back them as they shoot Palestinians.
Right.
So it's just lawlessness.
Yeah. Well, I'm really so sorry. And so your family, where were your parents born? Were they born there? And then.
No. So I have my grandparents were born there, and then a lot of my like uncles are still over there. My parents, they fled because my grandma and grandpa had to flee, in the 80s. And then, so my mother was born in Jordan, right. And my mother was born in Kuwait. My father was born in Jordan, and then they moved to the U.S. after Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait.
Wow. Yeah. Wow. Oh my gosh. Well, I'm so sorry. I don't even know what to say, right?
No, you're fine.
Words like kind of fail. Yeah.
That's a whole show right there.
Yeah, I know. Well, wow. I know.
I didn't know this, Wally. I mean, I knew I knew you were Palestinian. I just didn't know the background. Wow.
Yeah. Well, you know, we all have our own stories. So,
you can credibly tell this story so well because it gets off the radar too fast. What's going on?
Right. Yeah.
Especially because what's happening in Gaza, I mean, it's like the West Bank. It's almost like a paradise compared to Gaza. I mean, it's not, but it's
just... No, of course. I mean, they don't have bombs like flattening houses every day.
Right, but they have murder. It's just like slower and fewer people at a time.
Yeah, exactly.
Anyway, well, thank you so much for joining. We've already started recording because this has been so fascinating. And I actually, you know, I had you on. I'm having you guys on to talk about this story related to JFK, Israel and the nuclear bomb. And of course, though, what you're saying and in your biography is so important and fascinating and part of the discussion in some ways. I mean, we can talk about how it is and isn't, because of course, I'm not like pigeonholing you as a Palestinian who's like has a subjective perspective. I mean, you're also a journalist and an analyst. So, but I think that probably makes this story all the more perhaps meaningful and relevant, although it's relevant to anyone because we're talking about nuclear bombs. So Ken and Wally, welcome to the show. Welcome back, Ken. Welcome for the first time, Wally. Tell us about what you recently discovered and how you discovered it.
Yeah, absolutely. So funny enough, this actually, my whole JFK fascination started about 3 years ago now. And initially, I was just curious about why AIPAC was such a powerful lobby. I had nothing to do with John F. Kennedy. So I started looking into the history of AIPAC. And I found a website. Now the documents have went pretty viral. I'm not sure if you saw a lot of the, you know, AIPAC, the AIPAC's original documents, the how it was founded and everything. But there were FOIA requests in the early, I think mid-2000s on just basically every document coming out of AIPAC's origin. That's when I started. I started looking through that, and I started realizing, wait a second, the AIPAC was going through fighting with the State Department and the Department of Justice to register as a foreign agent. And it wasn't just, you know, one set of letters back and forth. They were, and it was John F. Kennedy's administration, of course. And the Department of Justice asked them to file as a foreign agent 7 times. So from there, and these are, you know, these documents are all available online. And from there, I started seeing, wait a second, I had no idea that John F. Kennedy was trying to have the entire Zionist lobby register as a foreign agent. His goal, you know, started with the American Zionist Council, which was AIPAC's predecessor. But the goal was to have the entire Zionist movement register as a foreign agent. And that really is what initially got me curious about John F. Kennedy. And then I started looking into it more because I was like, okay, well, this is interesting that they had such a sour relationship regarding AIPAC. What else is there related to, you know, John F. Kennedy in Israel? And what did you, you know, what was John F. Kennedy's stance towards the Palestinians? So, and that started about a 3-year journey looking into it. But the way it really, the way I started learning about the bomb was really through that. And I started to realize, I was also going through a lot of documents now. George Washington University, a professor at George Washington University was able to send a lot of FOIA requests and received a lot of documents. And these documents were also, I'd say, in the mid-2000s as well. And it was directly related to John F. Kennedy talking back and forth with Israel's first prime minister, David Ben-Gurion, on Israel's development of nuclear weapons. Media doesn't touch on this too much, but it's probably some of the most shocking documents that I think anybody, any American should really know to understand the U.S.-Israel relationship. Because right. At the time, Israel was nowhere near as close as they are to the United States now. Nothing like it was today. And John F. Kennedy wanted it to stay that way. He felt that it would be good for the interests of Israel and the United States and the rest of the world if the United States treated Israel as an equal to the rest of the Arab world, because he knew it would alienate the Arabs. And this was during the Soviet Union. So he was worried that if he got too close to Israel, the Arabs would get close to the Soviets.
Right.
They didn't want that. So he's like, they have to be a fair player. John F. Kennedy was also really big on stopping nuclearization globally, not just in Israel, but just across the planet. I mean, he did the nuclear treaty with Russia. So he was going back and forth with Israel's first prime minister, David Ben-Gurion. And David Ben-Gurion just kind of kept hopping around the subject. And he didn't want to directly address it. Israel was built, had the Dimona nuclear reactor, the Dimona nuclear site, and the French were helping them actually build it. And John F. Kennedy kept asking and pressing for American inspections at the site. And the Israelis were just going back and forth. They, you know, they brushed around it. They wouldn't give exact dates. They let American inspectors eventually come, and they actually built fake rooms inside the Dimona nuclear site. So that way they can kind of confuse, you know, like basically lie to the Americans and show them just fake setups,
right,
and not really show them everything going on. So that was really interesting. What I found most interesting about this is that during the time that John F. Kennedy was fighting, really, it was a silent battle, arguing with Israel's prime minister about the development of nuclear weapons, the chief of counterintelligence at the CIA was actively going against John F. Kennedy's wishes and working with Israeli Mossad to help them develop nuclear weapons. And this is all, again, on paper. The recent John F. Kennedy files released a lot of this, but there was also some prior releases that really started looking into this. His name is James Jesus Angleton.
Oh yeah.
So I started to realize, you know, if it was just the AIPAC thing, I was like, okay, this is interesting. But then I started to realize it was a set of things. The entire relationship was sour. It wasn't just related to the nukes. He was, you know, trying to have the Zionist lobby register. He was trying to stop Israel from developing nuclear weapons. He, and this is shocking, it was John F. Kennedy's administration put forward a UN resolution to force Israel to accept Palestinians and allow for the right of return. So not just, you know, this was prior to 1967, but the resolution was to allow Palestinians that were displaced in 1947 to return back to their homes. David Ben-Gurion, the first prime minister of Israel when this happened, and there's New York Times articles still out on this. The New York Times headline at the time, this was also the day before his assassination, it said, U.S. stand angers Israel to the strongest terms. And they were infuriated. And David Ben-Gurion sent a letter to Jewish American leaders in the United States. And he said that he will treat this resolution as a more serious threat than all the Arab leaders and dictators, than all of Nasser's missiles. Nasser was the president of Egypt. He said he would fight it down to the last man. So, I mean, it just goes to show how sour the relationship was.
Right. Well, before we get into the actual documents, I just want to say, Ken, do you want to add anything before we get into the actual video?
Wally's covered it really good. The only thing I would add is Angleton was one of the founders of the Mossad. Okay. So remember, they had to create an intelligence service and they looked to the CIA. And Angleton, he's got two memorials to him in Israel. He was called the number one Zionist in America by Israeli leaders. He was allowed somehow to operate a kind of off the book CIA. And somewhere I had this file. Oh, here it is. If I could just read this briefly, and then because it really explains the role of Angleton. This is a
Jewish, Angleton?
What's that?
Was Angleton Jewish?
No, it's really
no,
it's
right? Yeah.
What he was the son of a fascist American businessman who had a business in Milan during the Mussolini era. And he was very anti-communist.
Right.
Okay. Like rabidly so. So anybody that would help fight the communists, they were his friends. And he saw Israel as the spearhead against communism in the Middle East. Right. So here's this thing. It was finally let out a couple of years ago. I just want to read it and then we'll go to the other. But this really, it's very important. In the way of background, the control file was created to give us the opportunity of closely monitoring our liaison with Angleton on a variety of matters which were not reported through normal CIA channels. So in other words, this guy was able, even though he was the head of counterintelligence, he was able to have his own CIA within the CIA. His records were not integrated with the rest of the CIA. And here's the next line, and this is the one they redacted originally that's now been unredacted. CIA directors plural, because he was in there for as long as Hoover was head of FBI practically, CIA directors permitted Angleton, and here's the punchline, to run several intelligence projects, many of them with the redacted, the unredacted is the Israeli intelligence services. Okay, so multiple CIA directors let Angleton run his own intelligence projects with the Israeli intelligence service, and that was redacted until very recently in the Kennedy files. That only just came out recently. So wow. I just wanted to give that perspective on Angleton and Israel. And because it almost sounds crazy, the CIA guy was helping Israel get material for a nuclear weapon. Yeah, he was. He had his own little operation. Anyway, sorry to go off on that tangent.
No,
that's important.
Yeah.
And so after all of this started happening, I submitted my own FOIA request to the National Archives. Because I started doing some research about the fact that the chief of the IDF was in Dallas the day JFK was assassinated. And I had no idea about this before. This really shocked me. So I couldn't find any documents on this. So I submitted a FOIA request to the State Department. They got back to me about like 3 months later and they sent me the documents and I have them. I share them. I'll send you the link to them later, actually. Not only was the IDF in Dallas the day JFK was assassinated, they were on a 2-week trip across the United States to tour for military installations. Because John F. Kennedy wanted Israel to stop developing nuclear weapons so much, he basically made them a deal that the United States would sell Hawk missiles to the Israelis as long as they promised to allow for nuclear inspections. So the IDF came on this military installation tour on these Hawk missiles. And then the moment, just right before JFK was assassinated, I believe by like six or seven hours, the IDF cut their trip short, and it should have been extended for an additional 4 or 5 days. And they stated they cut their trip short because there were, you know, changes in their chain of commands, and then they immediately fled back to Israel. And this was Yitzhak Rabin. So that was, so it's just small stuff like that. And you really start to understand there's a lot about the JFK assassination people don't know. The former CIA officer and whistleblower, John Kerouac, he recently did a video, he did some interview a few weeks ago, and he said that one of his sources at in the US government was telling him that there are still 10,000 files related to Israel and JFK that they're just simply not going to see the light of day.
Wow.
You know,
can I just jump in and say two things? 90% of Angleton's files were destroyed after he was removed from the CIA. So when we say release the files, what are you going to release? They went into an incinerator. The other thing, and this is really important perspective for what Wally's going to be talking about. Wally's not welcome on the Reddit discussion board related to Kennedy assassination, right?
Oh, yeah.
So this material, it's not getting out there to the assassination community because he is being actively suppressed within the assassination community, research community, just so everybody understands the perspective on this. So you're hearing this, you're not going to hear it from what I call the assassination industrial complex, research complex. Like, they don't want to hear about this Israel stuff.
Right. Wow. Yeah. Well, thanks for that important context. Wally, introduce to us this video that you're going to show. How did you even come across it?
Yeah, so, you know, this throughout my research, what I started doing is whenever I would read American media about John F. Kennedy's relationship with Israel, I always wanted to see what the Israelis were saying at the exact same time. Because what I started to realize is that Israeli media is more honest about the Israeli feelings than American media is. American media likes to hide it. So I started going through Israeli media, and this was prior to even finding this clip, and I started to realize.
Just really quickly, I have to add this, and this is a little off topic, but it's just such a great example, which is that if you look at, for instance, the way that rape has been reported on, right? So there was the mass rape hoax, everyone said, and the Western media and all these politicians and quote unquote feminists talked about the mass rape that happened on October 7th. It actually didn't. But Israel has reported, at least they've reported on the rape of Palestinians. I mean, that in that one case, right, there's that one really gruesome case of a Palestinian hostage detainee who's grabbed and taken behind a shield and basically gang raped. And it's Israel reports on it that way. It's not like we don't know what happened behind those shields. It's like, this was a rape. He was injured. He had to be hospitalized. And then, as people may know or may not know, because the Western media doesn't cover it, there were, when they attempted to even arrest some of those soldiers or question them, there were protests, right to rape protests, they were dubbed, where people protested against the attempt to bring any accountability. And then you had a member of the Knesset saying, he was asked rhetorically if it was legitimate to insert sticks into people's rectums. And he said, yes, it is. And yes, it is legitimate. And then you had a rabbi bless one of the rapists. And then these rapists became like stars, pops, like on television. And I just bring this up because, you know, Dana Bash, Jake Tapper, Hillary Clinton, Sheryl Sandberg, none of the Western media has, it, to the extent that they've reported on it at all, it's been in like the New York Times, very, you know, they don't use the word rape. And it's very far down in the article. This angers me so much, but I bring this up because Israeli media totally reports on this. Like, this Absolutely. Is, this is headline news in Israel, and you have to be, and none of the people who claim to care about rape or sexual assault on television, CNN anchors, et cetera, ever talk about this. But anyway, back to you about the...
No, you're right. And they brag about it there too. That's the thing. They brag about it, and then US media covers it up. It's the fact that they brag about it that's so irritating. So, I mean, they do this with every, you know, any topic. They'll share one side, and then the American media will share the side that makes them look better. Right. Than,
or the Hannibal directive also. They talked about it in Israel. They didn't talk about it here.
Exactly. So, I mean, this is the theme with Israeli media. When it came to John F. Kennedy, Israeli media at the time and up until now, they would mock him. There was apparently some artist in New York City back in the 60s when John F. Kennedy was alive who made a nude portrait of John F. Kennedy. Very odd. American media didn't touch on it at all. Israeli media headlined it for like 3 days and they just kept mocking him about it. So it's small stuff like that. You really start to recognize the relationship was sour. Now, when it comes to this nuclear weapons development, Americans don't know about this. You know, I'd say after October 7th, more people started to wake up. I think now it's a bit more common that, you know, especially the younger generation, they realize it was a sour relationship. But prior to October 7th, especially, most Americans had no idea about John F. Kennedy's relationship with Israel. And the Israelis, on the other hand, they knew very, very well what was going on, because Israeli media was not only reporting about it, but laughing and mocking John F. Kennedy. So back in 2022, there's an Israeli comedy show. I believe it's called the Jews. I believe it's The Jews Among Us. I'm gonna have to double check. I have it listed in my description. They made an entire series related to Israeli prime ministers and their relations with U.S. presidents since Israel's inception, and they made a skit on Israel, on John F. Kennedy with David Ben-Gurion, Israel's first prime minister. An entire skit is basically David Ben-Gurion jumping around whether or not he should tell JFK about the nuclear weapons and just basically hiding it and glossing over it. Right. So Israeli media laughed at it. They made it a comedy skit.
Right. Okay, so let's take a look at this sketch.
And then when you mix it with jam,
yes,
it becomes kochmuch.
Interesting.
It's delicious.
Okay, Prime Minister, what can you tell me about the nuclear reactor in Dimona?
You know.
I don't. Is it for civil purposes, other purposes?
What's the difference?
There is a difference.
Tomato, potato.
Well, can you tell me something about the Dimona project?
Yes, 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 of course. Well, the situation in Dimona is very similar to Piñata. No further question, Your Honor. With great responsibility, don't ask what you can do for your country, Jolene, Jolene. Don't take my man.
I don't understand. Excuse me.
Look.
Yes?
I am your father. Prepare to die.
What?
And I say, what about breakfast at Tiffany's? She said my milkshake brings all the boys to the yard.
Sir, I don't understand exactly what you are talking about.
Okay, Mr. President. Let me try to clarify. My country.
So obviously, as of right now, right, it's just making fun of how much he's obfuscating and avoiding the question. Okay.
Yep.
Country. And all the Arabs in the Middle East. As you probably know, because of the Holocaust.
Sir, can you please
ask? So that's also mocking. I mean, and you know, Shalomi Aloni, who was a member of parliament and a minister under Yitzhak Rabin, she during a famous interview with Amy Goodman, she basically said, you know, it's our trick. Whenever we get criticized, we talk about the Holocaust or anti-Semitism. And this is kind of what they're doing here, I think, making fun of. But
answer my question.
Oh, that's Bobby, I guess. Bobby Kennedy.
Sir, can you please answer my question?
Write it, please.
Sir, are you manufacturing a nuclear bomb?
Probably not.
Probably?
Possibly, yes.
Are you?
Plummy-pip-plop.
Well, are you?
Scabra beep.
What?
Scabra ba tubli papa tubli little papa. Scabra don and tan don and tan don and tan don and tan don and bang gorion. I'm a scat man.
Okay, so there you have it.
So, there you go. And I don't even find their comedy, you know, it's not even funny.
No.
But that's how they, I mean, you have to understand, this was in 2022. So they wouldn't have done a skit like this if they didn't think that most of their population had some idea of the relationship enough to laugh at it.
Sure.
Because if they had no idea about the relationship, then it would be kind of hard, you know. So it has to be common enough in Israeli society to some degree to understand, okay, this is what the relationship was like. They really, you know, they really didn't like John F. Kennedy. And now American media paints an entirely different picture on the relationship between the two. But if they're willing to, you know, say it out loud and just kind of make these sort of skits, then they're proud of it. They're proud of the fact, and they think it's funny that their first prime minister lied to John F. Kennedy about nuclear weapons development.
Right.
Now, in the United States, we're not doing anything like that. This was the only skit, actually, that they had that was in English. The rest of the entire series is all in Hebrew, but I guess it was because it was with JFK, they decided to do it in English. So I initially found it because I was looking through documentaries of John F. Kennedy's relationship with Israel, and I found an interview by an Israeli that was touching on it, and then he mentioned the skit, and he said it's actually exactly like the skit from the show. And then I was like, wait a second, what's the show? And I went down a wormhole. I had to create a VPN in order to access Israeli media. It was a whole thing, but that's how I ended up pulling it out.
I just want to emphasize what Wally's saying. And you know this too, because you're a comedian, Katie, right?
Yeah.
I mean, the whole country had to know the backstory or that joke wouldn't have made any sense.
Yeah, right. It would have fallen flat. Yeah.
Yeah. So this means that while we're running around thinking we're discovering, you know, here in America, we think we're discovering, you know, papers and documents and we're digging deep. Every Israeli in the street knows that this nuclear scam was played on us by Ben-Gurion. And we're just figuring it out. What is it, 2026? We're all like getting advanced now. I mean, it's quite a gap.
Right.
And by the way, I have to bring this up one more time.
Yeah, yeah.
Where is the assassination research community? How have they managed to keep all... We know who shined Jack Ruby's shoes the day before he shot Oswald. We don't even know that Israel was been joking about the Kennedys and mocking them when every Israeli in the street knows all about it. What a gap.
Wow. Well, you know, it's interesting because I wanted to show something that is related to this. I interviewed Norman Finkelstein the other day, and as I was preparing, I watched, you know, his most recent appearance on Piers Morgan, and he was on with Jonathan Conricus, who's an IDF international spokesman. He's a retired lieutenant colonel, and he's been involved in many crimes, war crimes, including at Al-Shifa Hospital. Now, if you're watching this stream live, you are in luck because you got to see that entire fascinating conversation about JFK and how Israel mocked him through comedy and made light of their nuclear weapons program. But if you're watching this later and you want to see that fascinating discussion, you can do that at patreon.com/theKatieHalperShow. Again, that's patreon.com/theKatieHalperShow at the $5 a month level. Now, back to the interview. But you know, they actually talk about the nuclear weapons here. Hold on. Let me just get this ready because I didn't think of it until right now. One second.
Yeah, and while you're doing that, I'll also say that the producer of Mr. and Mrs. Smith, Arnon Milchin, he was, while he was producing the movie Mr. and Mrs. Smith, he was an undercover Israeli spy. He was an undercover Israeli spy, from 20 to his 50s, and he stole U.S. nuclear weapons equipment and sent it to Israel. And the U.S. State Department, they didn't want to renew his visa during Obama's administration, but Netanyahu pushed the State Department and lobbied them to renew Arnon Milchin's visa. And they stole gas-filled tubes that are nuclear weapon switches. So there's so much history to this whole thing that just kind of goes under the rug.
Right.
Wally, did you know that he was the producer of the movie JFK?
Yes, I did know that too, which is, I mean, that just goes to show what was the interest in wanting to do that, you know?
Yeah. Wow.
Well, let's take a look at this. I think it's pretty relevant. So this is Norman Finkelstein being hilarious and smart as always at the same time. Here he is with Conricus. Hold on. And you'll see why this is relevant.
So now let's get to the question.
Yeah.
The question is whether Israel has the right to defend itself. Basically. Okay.
Get to the question.
By all means.
Pierce. Number one, there has always been an option to significantly diminish the threat to Israel. There has always been an option. It's to create a weapons of mass destruction free zone in the Middle East. We have one in Latin America, a weapons of mass destruction free zone. We have one in Africa. We have one in the South Pacific. What's the obstacle? There is one obstacle to eliminating all nuclear weapons in the Middle East, all nuclear weapons in the Middle East, to significantly diminish the threat to Israel. We have that option. Who's blocked it? Who has refused? Iran has gone along with it. All the other Middle Eastern states have gone along with it. Only one state, the one who pretends to be for peace and for security, which has opposed the weapons of mass destruction free zone in the Middle East, that's Israel. Iran is a signatory to the Non-Proliferation Treaty. Is wow. Israel a signatory to the Non-Proliferation Treaty? In fact,
Pierce, is he going to answer questions or just freewheel all day long? Like, is, I mean, I answer your questions. I don't sit here and just pontificate. Mm-hmm. You ask me a question, I answer it. Is this going to carry on all night?
Norman, that, you know, I did just ask a simple question. Is Israel not entitled to defend itself from Iran?
Israel has the right to defend itself under Article 51 of the UN Charter. If
John, look at the IDF guy. He's like, he's upset because he doesn't want to hear about actual, you know, human rights law.
Exactly.
It's an imminent, irreversible threat to its national sovereignty. You can't invoke a future possibility sometime into the future as grounds for launching a war.
It is for launching a war. It's present and past. It's not future. It's present and past. Really, I have to intervene here because you're saying so many things.
Mr. Kornikis.
Yeah, you're saying so many things that are ridiculous.
Well, Jonathan, we should be able to get people's names right. So his name is Jonathan Conricus. Let's please use the right name.
Yeah, but I mean, listen,
Conricus.
Jonathan, if it's too difficult, Mr. Jonathan. Professor Finkelstein. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
You don't have the right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, listen, it's a really clear case, very basic situation. From an Israeli perspective, we are under threat. We are at the receiving end of Iranian ballistic missiles. We're at the receiving end of Iranian funding.
Yeah, it's interesting. Who bombs whom? Who starts these off? It's always Israel that starts bombing Iran. And when Iran responds, I mean, before, in one of the earlier clashes or conflicts, Iran totally, like, they don't want to kill civilians, right? They give warnings. They telegraphed exactly where their missiles were going to go. I'm not talking about during the recent wars on Iran. But, you know, it's such an inversion of the truth. Every accusation is a confession because Israel is the one that targets civilian infrastructure. And it's not defensive what Israel's doing. And what Iran is doing is defensive. But let's go back to the video because it's just unreal.
It's an armed terror organization. So if there ever was a justification for a sovereign country to defend itself and take military action against an aggressive, hostile state, nation state, then it's Israel against Iran. And sure, we can debate the U.S. perspective on it, and we can debate how smart it is. I actually think that it's very smart to take care of an enemy that says that he wants to destroy you, just doesn't have the real capability to do so yet. I think it's exactly the right.
It says it wants to destroy you. He's talking about a government that had issued a fatwa against nuclear weapons.
Yep.
Right. So there are people who say things, who chant things in the streets, perhaps. But Israel is the one who's engaging in an active genocide. All of a sudden, these guys care a lot so much about words. Like Aaron Maté, my co-host on Useful Idiots, always jokes like, what about sticks and stones may break my bones? A concept that little kids have mastered, and somehow Israel hasn't mastered that.
I mean, this is the thing. It's so irritating. They'll constantly ask, you know, people to, and they'll use it as some sort of moral high ground, whether you believe Israel has a right to exist or not. But Israel already exists. Palestine doesn't. You should be asking a separate question. You know what I mean? It's just ridiculous. Yeah. I don't care. It doesn't matter when the other side doesn't exist.
Exactly right. Yeah. And also, how does existing, I mean, you don't have to bomb people to exist. They almost make it seem like in order to exist, they have to be engaging in genocide and
war. You know, in 2023, there was, and I the video went viral everywhere except in the United States, 57 Arab and Muslim countries, all 57 of them, 57, which was insane. They all came together on Al Jazeera and they all stated publicly, one of them was the speaker for the entire Arab and Muslim Council, I believe. And he stated that they will immediately recognize Israel right the second not only recognize and ensure Israel's security, all 57 countries across the world, Muslim countries, as long as Israel immediately recognizes Palestine on the 1967 borders with East Jerusalem as its capital, Israel immediately turned it down.
Right.
None of this would be happening. No war, nothing. Iran already stated if the Palestine is recognized, they'd be open to recognizing Israel as well. This is Iran. This, I thought this is their mortal enemy. I thought they always wanted peace. You were handed peace on a silver platter. Exactly. And you chose
it's not even a one state, it's a two state solution that they're being offered, right? They're not even,
Exactly. And I feel like they're just leading to a one state. They're just going to lead to a, you know, they're going to lead themselves to a one state for equal rights for all people because they're erasing the alternative.
Right. Yeah, I know. Inshallah, that happens. All right. Let me go back to this video because there's more great stuff. But very good point, Wally.
The right thing to do to take care of that enemy and make sure that they don't have the means to fulfill their dreams of destroying or even threatening to destroy you. And weapons of mass destruction in the hands of religious zealots and ayatollahs and people who dream about, you know, a Muslim caliphate and who govern their own country by oppression, who murder people on the streets, who hang gay people from cranes and who oppress everybody who doesn't conform. I mean, nuclear weapons are horrible everywhere. They can be potentially horrible everywhere. But in the hands of people who have zero morals, zero respect for human life, that's the worst place for them to be. And frankly, sir, I don't think that the example of China is relevant. It could have been relevant in the 50s. And maybe then that could have been a smart thing. But I don't know, and I don't think it's really relevant today. What is relevant today is that Iran was pursuing nuclear weapons program, and they were trying to build bombs, and they were enriching uranium. They were hiding their nuclear weapons program. They were trying to deceive the International Atomic Agency, and the world caught wind of it. Israel exposed it. The U.S. exposed it. Europeans, who are, I don't think you can blame them for being action prone or wanting to, you know, to be belligerent, but they actually saw and understood the threat, and they said, okay, let's deal with it in terms of sanctions. And they applied sanctions on the Iranian regime in order to give it an opportunity to course correct.
Okay, but Jonathan, you're talking there about the need for Iran to be transparent and open and honest about its nuclear capability, about its nuclear aspirations. And yet, of course, the one country in the world which resolutely refuses to be remotely transparent about its nuclear capability is Israel. I've asked Netanyahu directly many times. I asked Naftali Bennett, the former prime minister, last week. Nobody ever wants to give a straight answer. So let me just ask you. You said you answer my questions. Does Israel have nuclear weapons? Yes or no?
Listen, as far as I know, and as you know, not the prime minister, not even close to it, way above my pay grade. But as far as I understand, Israel does possess significant capabilities. But officially, Israel says it maintains this policy of ambiguity.
Why?
I think at this stage, the organizations, enemies, and people who need to know, they know. And I'm specifically focusing on our enemies. And
yeah, but you understand why people like me look at it and go, hang on a sec. So you guys are all over Iran about their nuclear capability, and you want to have full transparency. You don't want anyone misleading anybody. And yet when it comes to your own nuclear weapons, you know, you're about the first Israeli guest I've ever had, I think, who's openly said, yeah, we've got them. But the idea that your government can just not answer that question and is the only country in the world that doesn't give an answer to that question, why does Israel get a pass? I don't understand it.
Well, I think it's fundamentally different when you try to compare Iran and Israel. We aren't the ones.
Well, let me compare you to the UK. Why should the UK be open and transparent about its nuclear capability, but Israel get a pass? I don't understand why you. There's one rule for Israel, and another rule for everybody else has got them.
But even more substantially, Piers, why should anybody have nuclear weapons?
What is he doing? I mean, it's such a goalpost moving.
Why does the UK have them? For what purpose? What does it serve France? What does it serve Russia, China, US?
Well, obviously they have them as a deterrent, as I assume Israel does. But again,
there you go.
The French are open about it. The British are open about it. The Americans are open about it. The only country that isn't is Israel.
Yeah, but I mean, what's more important, whether you have it or not, or whether you speak about it? I mean, I think it's something that, frankly, it's one of those Israeli policies that I actually don't understand myself. I've questioned it a few times and sought answers to really understand the reason behind it. The way I analyze it is that it was a policy that was policy or principle that was formulated many, many years ago, maybe in the 60s. And at the time, it served a purpose while capabilities were being generated. And then it probably just carried on with inertia. And maybe a future prime minister of Israel will say, you know what, world, yes, we have them. We're armed with them, and we can use them in order to defend ourselves against an existential threat.
I think
threat.
That would be an excellent idea if Israel was just honest about it. Yeah, okay.
Yeah, I personally would support it, but I mean, would that change the situation, the calculus regarding a crazy religious fundamental regime like Iran?
No, no. I just think if you're going to lecture other countries about being transparent about their nuclear capability. Aspirations, you've got to be yourself. Otherwise, you're a hypocrite.
No, I mean, my issue with Iran is that they tried to destroy the state of Israel. They openly say that their national goal is to annihilate us.
Yeah, I'm not quibbling
with that. It's not so much about transparency. It's about the fact that they want to kill us all.
I understand. But I've got to leave it there. Thank you both very much indeed for the debate. I appreciate it.
That's pretty ridiculous. He does some good job there, Pierce, kind of calling out the hypocrisy, but then, of course, he lets him end on a big lie, which is that Iran wants to destroy Israel.
I love how they talk about a crazy religious regime that
exactly.
wants to injure its neighbors. Are they talking about Israel or who are they talking about?
Who talks about Amalek?
Yeah.
Who also, you want to talk about theocracy? Who right now has a Department of War, which used to be called Department of Defense, run by a religious maniac who has like a tattoo from the Crusades? And which army is getting phone calls? Which army is telling its soldiers that Trump has been anointed by Jesus Christ?
It's, you know, this is absolutely wild. The idea that you can actually, the Pope made it. I think he made a statement today, actually. And he said that you can't use God to justify war.
Wow.
And this was directly in relation. I think he posted this on X today. It was either today or yesterday. And he said, you can't be using God to justify war. That's, you know, basically that's not how God works. God doesn't take side in bloodshed.
Right.
So, you know, this is absolutely insane. And this is the thing, Pete Hegseth specifically, this staunch evangelical Christian, there was a video that was previously going viral of him. This was years back where he stated that the Dome of, you know, it's going to be a miracle when the Third Temple is built on the Dome of the Rock.
And Mike, what about Mike Johnson, who like arranged to have a red heifer brought somewhere to Israel because there's some religious mishigas with that?
You know, Hamas stated that was part of the reason they used for October 7th because farmers in Texas decided to send six red heifers to Israel, six red cows, and they spent like $8 million on it. And Hamas recognized that that was in an attempt to eventually destroy the mosque, which is, you know, right. one of the holiest sites in Islam. It's insane how religious, you know, fanaticism is tying into all of this.
Right.
They named their operation after the mosque.
Right. Al-Aqsa Flood, right?
Yep. To protect, yeah.
Unbelievable. So my question is this, though. How does this nuclear, and then there's the Samson option, right? Can you guys talk about the Samson option? Because what I'm really trying to understand is, could the United States, even if it wanted to, which they don't, but could they just disarm Israel? Or are they actually afraid that Israel is just going to use a nuke?
Well, you know what? To answer that from the side, Wally, you should really tell the story about the Israeli military being afraid of that very thing in the 60s.
Yeah, right? Absolutely. So, definitely. So
and then we'll come to the present. But there's a historical precedent. And Wally dug this stuff out. I just want to say this, guys. He's digging stuff out nobody else is digging out. I mean, I'm amazed at his research. Anyway.
No, I appreciate it. Thank you. While John F. Kennedy was fighting with Israel to stop the development of nuclear weapons, the Israelis, they hosted many meetings about this with the second prime minister of Israel. Oh my gosh, it's slipping my mind. Who was the second prime minister that was going back and forth? And it'll come to me while I'm speaking.
I think.
I think it'll come to me while I'm speaking, but his face is in my head right now.
What's his name?
But regardless, I think if I talk a little bit more, I'll start to remember it through what I'm reading. Regardless, they hosted a meeting and they basically
Charette, talked about Moshe Charette.
No.
And then Levi Eshkol.
It was
Ben Gurion, Moshe Charette, Ben Gurion, Levi Eshkol. Yeah.
Yeah, Ben Gurion left and came back. So Levi Eshkol hosted a meeting and they were talking about these, you know, these nuclear weapons and how John F. Kennedy was trying to stop them. And the chief of the Air Force, the Israeli Air Force at the time, stated they actually started having a discussion, a threat analysis on how likely it would be that if the Americans found out about Israel developing nukes, how likely it would be that John F. Kennedy would order the U.S. troopers to come in and confiscate Israel's nuclear weapons. This is how, you know, this is how threatened they were by the idea of John F. Kennedy finding out. They were so threatened that they actually did a threat analysis on it. Like, how likely is this? What would happen if the United States sent U.S. paratroopers to come in and actually seize it? Seize the nuclear weapons, seize the nuclear equipment, or sorry, seize the enriched uranium, which is exactly what the United States is attempting to do to Iran now. So also really interesting, Israel became nuclearized by 1967, right prior to the Six-Day War. And they were considering actually doing a nuclear test. They ended up doing two nuclear tests in the Indian Ocean. They were considering, and I guess they didn't end up going through with it, with doing a nuclear test in the Sinai Peninsula before the Six-Day War to establish deterrence. But then they were worried, and there was pressure by likely the CIA chief at the time of counterintelligence not to do that because there was still fear of the Arabs going and leaning towards the Soviets and then starting a nuclear arms race in the Middle East, which they also didn't want, which is why this policy of ambiguity sticked. So, you know, this is how, you know, the level of fear that they had in this development of nukes. And now, you know, Germany gave Israel five submarines, and most of them are stationed in the Mediterranean Sea. I believe they have one in the Red Sea. So they're nuclear armed submarines. So even if Israel, you know, aside from just the Dimona nuclear site, Israel has nuclear armed submarines in the Middle East as well. So if there was any sort of attempt to seize them, I mean, it's not something you could just go in and do because it's not just in one site. And if you take them from one site, you have these nuclear armed submarines, and it's an entire, you know, and there's threat by doing that, because if you fail, you know, how could things be reciprocated? There's all of these, you know, threats, which is why it's so difficult unless countries like now, you know, do the South Africa style where they gave up their nukes willingly.
Wow. So, yeah. So my question is, I mean, that's really good historical precedent. My question is, though, like, what would happen if Israel used a nuclear weapon? What kind of capabilities do they have? And how hamstrung is the United States? Like, in other words, let's say they want to stop Israel. Are they afraid that if they try to, if they stop funding them, if they disarm them, if they did something, are they afraid that they would just use a nuke? And who could Israel nuke? That's another question I have. Like, how far ranging are their nukes?
Yes, absolutely. 100%. They are afraid that if they stop funding, Israel would use a nuke. And there's one full example. And then there was also even recently. So in the 1973 Yom Kippur War, Henry Kissinger, they were speaking in the U.S. government about withholding aid to Israel, military ammunition to Israel. Jonathan Pollard, the convicted Israeli spy, he bragged about this in the Jerusalem Post interview last month. And this clip is still on YouTube. I'll have to send it to you later. He bragged about the fact that during the 1973 Yom Kippur War, Henry Kissinger, they were considering, you know, withholding aid. And they sent a letter to the State Department and they said, you know, use your eyes in the sky and look down and look what's under our planes. And they were basically talking about using your satellites, like take a look at what we have attached to our planes, which was nuclear weapons. And they were basically willing to use unconventional weapons during the Yom Kippur War, nukes, if they didn't end up consistently getting aid. So then, of course, the U.S. government didn't want it to be known that Israel had nukes. They didn't want to start a nuclear arms race. So then immediately they started flying in the munitions and they continued giving it. John Kerouac, the former CIA officer, he did a interview, what was it, after the 12-day war. And he said, and this is what he said. So he said that somebody close to him at the Pentagon told him that he presented the plan for the 12-day war to Trump, and Netanyahu threatened that if the United States did not support it, then Israel would just go ahead and nuke Iran instead. So this is coming from, you know, this is just, you know, one source that we have stating this. Whether or not you want to take that source credible, I personally do. I mean, he worked at the CIA. He has connections. Regardless, a convicted Israeli spy brags about it himself that it was done back in 1973. So, you know, that it's just, they hold us hostage over it. Israel in 1948, there was Operation Cast Thy Bread when I guess it was prior to the IDF becoming the IDF, where they poisoned Palestinian water wells with typhoid. And they poisoned them to basically stop the Palestinians from returning back, and they used typhoid bacteria. So there was an analysis done on it about five, six years ago from Israelis, I think at Tel Aviv University, and they talked about the Samson option indirectly related to the typhoid bacteria. And they said that aside from the fact that Israel has the Samson option when it comes to nuclear weapons, Israel now also potentially has a biological Samson option, where if Israel doesn't get its way, it could consider also, you know, releasing some sort of biologic, which they previously did during Operation Cast Thy Bread. I don't think that gets talked enough about much either, which is, you know, so they're really willing to go. There's no stopping to how far they're willing to go. Even if it means that it would hurt themselves, really, they'll take the whole world down with them.
Right. Pretty scary.
You know, Hengstedt the other day, the Secretary of War, he was listing the future military capacities that the U.S. had to develop. One of them was biotechnology. He actually included that as a weapon of war. And obviously, there's a massive amount of intellectual property being shared between Silicon Valley and the biotech people in the Bay Area and the Israelis. I mean, they're like this. Right. So, yeah, they certainly, to the extent that kind of thing is possible, they're working on it really hard, for sure. There's no question about it.
That is so scary. Well, anything else you guys want to add? This has been a really great chat.
Well, I'll say this. No, I'm sorry.
No, you're fine. Go for it.
We once had a president that we voted for, or our grandparents and parents voted for him, who was trying to shut all this down. He was trying to make Israel follow the lobbying laws, the foreign lobbying laws. He was trying to shut down their nuclear weapons development. And he got a bullet in the head. And we keep talking about the mafia did it, the CIA did it, the Cubans did it, the Martians did it. And we never, ever, this whole community of assassination researchers never brings up the fact that there is a country that had the motivation, the means, and the opportunity to do it. Or to participate in it closely. I think Americans need to know about that possibility, that another group that needs to be put in the mix is potentially involved in the murder of John F. Kennedy and Robert F. Kennedy, the Zionists. I mean, it's just their policy of war is murdering leaders. So it would not be a stretch for them. The guy that ended up being president was a Christian Zionist, was very close to them. The guy who was, you know.
Who were you talking about?
Johnson. He was a Christian. He came from a Christian Zionist family.
I didn't know that.
Oh, he was a wackadoodle on that Zionist. Yeah, we think of Texas, you know. Texas is one of the breadbaskets of Christian Zionism, has been going back to the beginning.
Right.
So they had everything in place. They had a lot of allies. Angleton was an ally. We've already talked about him. Johnson was an ally. The FBI director just hated the Kennedys, so he could be counted on to go along with it. The news media is clueless. So it was a kind of an easy thing to pull off. I'm going to keep hammering this table on this. Where is the research, the assassination research community? There are guys that make full-time livings doing this research, and for some reason, the word Israel can never come from their lips.
Wow. Yeah, absolutely. No, and I mean, LBJ, he said it himself. Israel lost a great friend, but now found an even better friend after John F. Kennedy's assassination. And this is a direct quote. Anybody, it's very, very, you know, abundant. This is not some hidden secretive quote or anything. This is very well documented. He said this. So it just kind of goes to show in every single thing that John F. Kennedy did, every single thing that John F. Kennedy was trying to stop the Israelis from doing, completely flipped. Stop pushing for the Zionist lobby to register as a foreign agent. Stop pushing for Palestinians' right of return. Stop pushing for, you know, serious U.S. nuclear inspections on Israel. Everything totally dropped. There, you know, LBJ is known as the best friend in the White House that Israel's ever had. Donald Trump is probably the most useful idiot in the White House that Israel's ever had.
Right. Wow. So. Well, we'll have to have you guys back on because it's been great. And then we'll have to have a little discussion because I still think, and I know Norman Finkelstein thinks this, and there's like two polls here. You have the Mearsheimer thesis, which is that it's all the lobby. Then you have someone like Norman who thinks it's not just a lobby. I mean, there is a lobby, obviously, no one denies that, but that this is also consistent with perceived America's perceived national interests. And of course, one of the reasons it's so hard to have this conversation is because we have to establish what those national interests are and what those perceived national interests are, right? Because even like with 9/11, obviously that looks like it was something terrible, but you could see how it also was, according to some sociopaths in our government, president, vice president, et cetera, you could see how that could easily be framed as something that was in the national interest because then they got to, you know, apply their project for the new American century. So I do think it's complicated. It's not just the U.S. doing the bidding of Israel.
I couldn't agree more.
Yeah.
Israel. I think of Israel, you know, America as a gangster state.
Yeah.
And they put some little junior gangsters on a corner to sell crack. They're not going to personally go down and do all the terrible things. Right. They let Israel do. I mean, they keep talking about Israel as our personal aircraft carrier in the Middle East. I mean, and take this back to Kennedy. He's the man that invited the newly elected president of Algeria for the most lavish reception in the White House I've ever seen to honor the Arab speaking world's desire for independence and equality. Right. And that's another reason he had to go, according to the Zionists.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, this has been really fascinating. Thank you so much. And yeah, definitely come back.
I appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Katie.
Thanks. Thank you so much to everyone for watching the stream, for coming to the stream. Please don't forget to like the stream if you haven't already. Please don't forget to hit subscribe and the bell if you haven't already, because you're definitely going to want to make sure you catch the upcoming interview we're doing with Dr. Mohammed Mirandi, who's based in Tehran. Also become Patreon supporters so you can see that full interview with Ken and Wally. And you can do that at patreon.com/the Katie Halper Show. Again, that's patreon.com/the Katie Halper Show. Bye everyone. See you next week. Or actually before then, when I interview Dr. Mohammed Mirandi. But then I'll see you again next Tuesday at 7 p.m. Thanks again so much for listening to The Katie Halper Show. To hear the rest of that discussion, please join the Patreon at patreon.com/the Katie Halper Show. Again, that's patreon.com/the Katie Halper Show. Please leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. And as always, we remind you that this show could not happen without the support of our listeners. To support the show, visit patreon.com/the Katie Halper Show, where for just $1 a month, you help make this show happen. And for $5 a month, you get great bonus content, including extended interviews, bonus episodes, sneak peeks, and my upcoming documentary and early access interviews. Our show is produced by me, Katie Halper, and Brad Bloom. Brad Bloom and Andrew Calloway are the audio engineers, and our researcher is Nate Newborn. Our theme song is by the band Cordova. See you next time.
This episode sponsored by Forkful. Most meal delivery services promise healthy food, but look closer, and you'll often find cheap industrial seed oils hiding in the ingredients. Forkful does things differently. Forkful delivers chef-prepared meals made with premium ingredients you'd expect at a great restaurant, from center-cut filet mignon to wild-caught lobster mac and cheese. And every meal is 100% seed oil-free. Instead of canola or soybean oil, Forkful chefs cook with extra virgin olive oil, avocado oil, and grass-fed butter. Because better fats make better food. Meals arrive fresh, never frozen, with clear nutrition and ingredient transparency, so you always know exactly what you're eating. Restaurant-quality meals. Real ingredients. No seed oils. Discover Forkful today at ForkfulMeals.com. This episode sponsored by Forkful. Most meal delivery services promise healthy food, but look closer, and you'll often find cheap industrial seed oils hiding in the ingredients. Forkful does things differently. Forkful delivers chef-prepared meals made with premium ingredients you'd expect at a great restaurant, from center-cut filet mignon to wild-caught lobster mac and cheese. And every meal is 100% seed oil-free. Instead of canola or soybean oil, Forkful chefs cook with extra virgin olive oil, avocado oil, and grass-fed butter, Because better fats make better food. Meals arrive fresh, never frozen, with clear nutrition and ingredient transparency, so you always know exactly what you're eating. Restaurant-quality meals, real ingredients, no seed oils. Discover Forkful today at ForkfulMeals.com.